human technology got closer to Pluto today than it's ever been before. And at the lab that's controlling the New Horizons spacecraft?
The energy level is exceedingly high. Most people are operating on very little sleep at this point because we've been working for the last 2 weeks as images have been coming down.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, a judge tosses out a lawsuit over who controls staffers for the State Board of Education. What's the deal with a huge domestic military action in the Southwest? The calculations we go through to decide to help people during an emergency, and a Valley City takes control of more water.
To get another additional X amount of wells and facilities, and then just the water that's under the ground is a huge leap forward for the city for the future.
Plus, debates about dating, and yeah, we know it's Tuesday. That and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Yes, it's a Tuesday. Yes, this is, in fact, the show. No need to adjust your calendars. Quick check of Valley traffic. 60 eastbound, there's an accident on the connecting ramp to the 101 southbound. You'll want to avoid that area if you can. As far as the forecast goes, sunny and hot seem to be the way that we're looking. Partly to mostly sunny today with a high of 108. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny tomorrow with a high of 107, 108 for a high on Thursday. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 19%. It's sunny and 104 degrees at KJZZ. It's not often a state highway shares the same number as a baseball Hall of Famer. KJZZ's Catherine Fritke has more on the honor.
For 3 weeks beginning Friday, drivers along State Route 51 will see two signs honoring the big unit Randy Johnson. Johnson wore the number 51 during most of his professional career and will be inducted into the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York at the end of the month. He will be the first player from the Arizona Diamondbacks to be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Johnson played for the team from 1999 to 2004. Catherine Fricke, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Mexican Army says it seized more than $11.5 million in cash found aboard a truck carrying strawberries south from the U.S. border. It says the U.S. currency was found in 306 bundles wrapped in black tape. It was found Monday after a gamma ray inspection of the truck at a customs checkpoint a few miles from Sonoyta, just across the border from Lukeville, Arizona. The driver was detained. A judge has dismissed a lawsuit filed by State Schools Chief Diane Douglas. The suit had sought to clarify that she controls staffers for the State Board of Education. Joining me now to talk about this is Catherine Crino. She's education reporter for the Arizona Republic. She covers Diane Douglas, the State Education Department, and the Board of Ed. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
So remind us what this case was all about.
Well, back in February, Diane Douglas had tried to fire two top state board officials. And they were out of the office for a couple days. The governor stepped in and said, no, the state board is separate and you don't have the power to hire and fire state board staff. So there was a bill in the legislature that died. And so Diane Douglas took the matter to court. Today, the judge ruled that, no, the governor is right. Well, they didn't exactly say that, but in essence, the governor is right. She does not have the power to hire and fire state board members. She is only in charge of the Arizona Department of Education.
What was the judge's rationale for making that decision?
Well, basically, she just reviewed the law. What Diane had tried to argue in court is that she has the power to hire and fire state board staff because they are an extension of the State Board of Education, that the board doesn't even have the right to enter into its own contracts. The Department of Education should have to do that for them. And basically, the board attorneys then argued back saying, hey, this is all just a big political argument. The board and Diane Douglas do not get along, and she's trying to do a power grab in court. So the judge's ruling today was basically the board is separate. It has its own staff. It has its own funding from the legislature. The board can indeed enter into contracts, which it did recently by creating its own office for staff in the governor's tower, and the court agreed that it really should not be involved in political arguments between public officials.
Has Diane Douglas's office said whether or not she plans to appeal this?
They have not. The ruling was kind of a surprise. I talked to the two attorneys just yesterday, and they did not have word at all that this was going to happen. Early this morning, the judge released her ruling, and so everybody's still kind of reading it and studying it. It'll be interesting to see if she proceeds.
And lastly, Catherine, the relations between Diane Douglas's office and the State Board of Education have not been fantastic recently. Do you get the sense that this ruling might help that in any way?
I think I just interviewed the Board of Education President Gregory Miller, and he sounds optimistic. We'll just have to go to the next State Board of Education meeting and find out. There's been tension there, so stay tuned.
Catherine Crino is the education reporter for the Arizona Republic. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
After 3 billion miles and 9.5 years, NASA's New Horizons did a flyby of Pluto this morning. When Clyde Tombaugh discovered the dwarf planet in 1930 at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, the news was transmitted by telegram. Today, things are a bit different. New Horizons has been transmitting images and data back to Earth wirelessly. For more on what scientists have been seeing, we called Dr. Veronica Bray. She's a planetary scientist at U of A and on the New Horizons mission. We reached her this morning at the lab in Maryland where the spacecraft was built and is being controlled, and I asked her what it's been like there today.
It's exceptionally busy in one of the buildings at the Applied Physics Lab. There's all of the scientists. And it's quite a relief to be in our own building because there's about 1,000 media in one of the other buildings. But the energy level is exceedingly high. Most people are operating on very little sleep at this point because we've been working for the last 2 weeks as images have been coming down. But because it's the closest approach today, everyone is at least energized by adrenaline.
What are you most interested or excited to find from New Horizons? Like, what do you want to know the most?
My personal interest is for impact craters. The craters occur when a comet has hit Pluto. And it would be interesting for me to see a body covered with craters so that there's a lot to analyze. But I also, at the same time, I didn't want that. Because if you have a body covered in craters like the moon is for us, it means that there's not a lot of geologic activity. So I was actually hoping to see some craters, but not that many. And that's what we are seeing at the moment. We're seeing dark and light terrains that have different numbers of craters on them. So it shows us different levels of activity.
Of the information that you have gotten so far over the past, you know, couple of years from New Horizons, does it seem like Pluto is pretty much what scientists thought it was? I mean, has there been anything that's been a big surprise?
Not for me. I don't think many people were surprised with what we saw. We didn't expect it to be a totally dead world with just impact craters. We were expecting like different terrains and things like that. But it is, however, consistent with an icy body that we were expecting of a Kuiper Belt object.
How do you think that the information that you have been getting and will continue to get will and should be used by scientists? I mean, what can we really learn from all this?
We can learn a great deal, and it will occur slowly. So in the following weeks, there'll be a lot of preliminary results that come out, and then over time, when people really have the time to sit down and analyze the data properly, we might have to take back some of those preliminary conclusions as we study things further. The data that we're getting back now, it isn't just photos. We get compositional information. So the science team is going to be combining all of this so that we can look at the surface and the dark patches and the light patches, we can find out what their compositional differences are, like what are they made up of.
Because we're in Arizona and Pluto obviously has sort of a special place in the state's heart, do you think that anything that we find out or see from New Horizons will lead to Pluto potentially becoming a planet again?
Officially, I am not supposed to have an opinion on this as a member of the science team. However, I can speak to this personally as long as I can specify that my personal opinion. I don't think that anything we find will make a difference. Even though we're getting photos back now of this geologically interesting world, it won't change the fact that Pluto isn't there on its own. It's one of a massive belt of objects just like Pluto. People on the team don't generally refer to Pluto as a planet, but they will refer to it as king of the Kuiper Belt. It's the largest object of a belt of Pluto-like bodies.
Veronica Bray is a planetary scientist at U of A and on the New Horizons mission. She's in Baltimore for the rest of the week, which is where we reached her. By the way, she mentioned that before everyone gathered leading up to today's flyby, conference calls with all the researchers who are spread out across the country could get a bit dicey.
One of the funny points of a team telecon, before I came out here to Baltimore, I was having to get up for 5 a.m. telecons, Tucson time.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a little while for all of us absent-minded scientists to ring in. And so one person was sitting there timing how long it took all scientists to come online. And when it occurred, he then mentioned that the time it took the team to assemble for a telecon, in that time, New Horizons would have traveled the distance from California to Germany.
Oh, man. That couldn't have made you feel that good.
No, we felt very, very tardy.
As of tomorrow, the West Valley city of Buckeye will own the part of Global Water Company that operates in the city. Dave Nye is Buckeye's Director of Water Resources. I asked him why the city made the $55 million purchase.
Well, there's a couple different reasons. One is with the economies of scale, meaning that we already have in the city itself, we've already got a finance, we've got HR, we've got all the different entities inside of the city. We didn't need to duplicate that effort. So that's the main thing. We could do it at less money than they could do it for providing the service to the customers, as well as because the bulk of their service area inside of the city limits is kind of like a big donut hole inside the city. It's right smack in the middle. And because of that, if we wanted to encourage any type of economic development to bring in additional industrial commercial customers, they have to deal with the private water company as well as the city for all their normal routine permitting processes. And it lets us control our own destiny. We can work with companies. We can work with somebody on the amount of water they need and whatnot. So those are a couple of the biggest reasons. The other reason really is, quite frankly, we hold our water quality to a higher standard as a municipality than some of the private water companies. So we feel that for the residents of the city of Buckeye, we'll be able to provide them with a better product at least the same price, if not less than what they would have to pay to a private company.
Given all the scarcity that we've been hearing about and that we know about here in Arizona, is there something comforting for the city to basically own its own water supply?
It's actually a huge thing. Buckeye is unique from the rest of the valley, or a large portion of the rest of the valley, where we are 100% dependent on our groundwater supply. And by that, I mean the city of Buckeye gets no water from the CAP, from the SRP, from any of the canals. Our water comes completely and 100% from underground wells. So for us to control more and more of the water underneath the city land itself is a huge portion. So for us to get another additional X amount of wells and facilities and then just the water that's under the ground is a huge leap forward for the city for the future.
Are there other cities either in Arizona or elsewhere that you know of that have done something like this?
Yeah, I think you'll find that if you look back even in the valley, usually with smaller companies, I think, the cities will go in and acquire them as they grow. And, you know, generally if growth starts from a center core and works its way out, the cities will absorb and purchase the water companies as they move. Buckeye is a little bit unique in that we're the largest city landmass-wise in the state of Arizona, and it has had some leapfrog development. So with that being said, to have the biggest portion of the Buckeye service area in Global be right smack in the middle of the main part of town, it really does benefit the city to be able to come in and take control of that. And, you know, we can interconnect the systems together. There's a lot of opportunities there.
Dave Nye is Director of Water Resources for the City of Buckeye. Dave, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come, screens, screens, everywhere a screen, but what effect are they having on our brains?
The more that those screens become good at projecting very high intensity light with a lot of pattern changes, we may start to see more seizures triggered.
How new media could pose a threat to epileptics. That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, and yes, it is Tuesday. We are aware of that. We're expanding the show now to Tuesdays to give you even more of our community. On the Valley Roadway, speaking of our community, the US 60 eastbound, an accident, it has closed the connection ramp to the 101 southbound. Again, that's the 60 eastbound. The ramp to the 101 southbound is closed. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today. Look for a high of 108. It'll be clear tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Right now, it's 106 degrees at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, committed to making light rail investments that have a positive impact on small businesses and help local economies flourish. More at valleymetro.org/connected.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. We have in America an elaborate judicial system to protect the rights of the accused with checks on government power. It oversees the arrest, trial, and sentencing of citizens who become criminal defendants, and it is that system that's responsible for the more than 2.5 million people behind bars.
But who decides on parole for those convicts? Who sets the terms of release for the more than 4.8 million people on probation or parole? It turns out that it is the 50 state parole boards across the country, each with their own rules, and in more than half the states with nearly unlimited power over who gets out of prison, when, and why. Tom Gratt is a former New York State Parole Board member from 2004 to 2010 who, along with Beth Schwartzapfel of the Marshall Project, undertook a month-long investigation into parole and criminal justice reform. The findings have been published by the Washington Post. Reporter Schwartzapfel says one way to think about a parole hearing is to think of it as a constitution-free zone.
As a general rule, there are no due process rights in front of a parole board. And that's because courts have found that prisoners who go before a parole board don't have what's called a liberty interest. And since they're not already free, they don't have any freedom to lose. And by not having freedom to lose, they lose the due process rights that come with the risk of losing your freedom.
Is there anything in the parole system, Tom, in your experience, which would prevent something like somebody who works in the corrections department has a vendetta against a particular prisoner for something that has nothing to do with their behavior and wants to make sure this fella never gets out on parole, to prevent that sort of thing from being abused? Is there anything like that? Or can somebody just make a phone call and basically their parole will be denied?
Well, interestingly, in New York, just to digress a little bit, the state legislature has generally been very reluctant to enact statutes or pass statutes and have the governor sign them relative specifically to parole. A lot of the parole policies and regulations in New York are the result of court cases filed by inmates and their attorneys expressing a concern about examples such like you just gave, where you'd have a guard or a corrections officer put something in a parole applicant's file that could negatively impact their appearance before the parole board. It would be a report, say a misbehavior report, which would go through the correction system, which would indicate that an inmate or a parole board applicant has not done very well inside from a behavior point of view.
And I will say in some states, you will get letters both from corrections officials and also from politicians. I know, for instance, in Alabama, the governor, the attorney general, a lot of the elected officials in that state are known to write letters in opposition to parole. And the parole board members told me personally that those letters carry great weight, even if those people don't have any personal knowledge of that particular case. And I will also say this is why transparency matters so much, that in 25 states, the contents of the file, basically the records, the letters and things the board uses to make its decision, are not open to the public. And in 19 states, they're not even open to the inmate himself.
Are there any objective criteria for what constitutes a approval for parole? You're being approved because of X, Y, and Z. Is it like that?
A lot of states now do have parole guidelines, but they're almost always advisory. So the board is free to depart from those guidelines for almost any reason.
The interpretation of the criteria can even vary among different parole panels within a state. You might come before, as an offender, might come before a parole board of people with maybe law enforcement backgrounds or prosecutorial backgrounds in 1 month, and your bunkmate might come up before a parole board the next month with the panel consisting maybe a social worker or non-law enforcement backgrounds. So there's a real confusion. You could have situations, again, obviously nothing is identical, but you could have people who are incarcerated who have committed very similar crimes, have very similar records within the correctional system, have a very similar release plan, and one could be denied and one could be granted release. It's a very arbitrary, at least on the surface, system that really defies explanation. In New York, there are three general factors that a parole board is required to consider by law. First off, would release at this particular time be incompatible with the welfare of society? The second criteria, is there a reasonable probability that if the person were released at this time, that they would remain at liberty without violating the law? And then the final one, would release at this time so deprecate the nature of the offense as to undermine respect for the law? These are incredibly vague criteria and can be interpreted in many different ways by sitting parole panels.
Beth, would you say that the deliberations in parole often or largely amount to a kind of have you been punished enough sort of discussion?
That's almost always one of the elements of the conversation. But a lot of people I spoke to in my reporting raised the question, the judge knew what the offense was when he or she sentenced this person however many decades ago. And even knowing that offense, they were sentenced to a sentence that made them parole eligible after a certain amount of time. So you would think that the seriousness of the offense is already built into the sentence that they received. Why should then the parole board again consider the same crime when the judge already knew that?
What are the qualifications to be on a parole board in New York, and what have you found around the country?
A New York college degree, basically a law enforcement type background or social sciences type background, and commensurate work experience. And then you have to be nominated by the governor and confirmed by the state senate. So there's indeed a political aspect to the job of parole board.
And nationally?
Nationally, the requirements to be a parole board member are very spotty from one state to the next. Some states, like New York, have pretty good, you know, basic requirements. Other states have zero basic requirements. Or if they do have requirements, they're sort of advisory in nature. They'll say a parole board member should have X number of years of experience. Or the fields that they dictate that the person should have experience in are vague and broad, like education or medicine. I saw a number of parole board members around the country who say were a high school English teacher, where they fit those minimum requirements. But, you know, one could ask, how is that person well positioned to understand the complexities of criminal behavior, of risk assessments, of what the different disciplinary proceedings mean within prison, all the things that you need to know to make good decisions?
What about the volume? How many cases are these boards seeing, and how extensive are the deliberations?
Well, New York is at an interesting crossroads because over the last decade and a half, New York has moved from an indeterminate sentence where you'd have a minimum and a maximum, and you would first see a parole board at the minimum, to a more determinate sentencing structure, where if you were sentenced to, say, 20 years, you would serve your 20 years minus generally 15% for good behavior. The interesting thing about that is that you could have people who've committed the same crimes, where some person in a determinate sentence would be incarcerated and released, another person is sentenced under an indeterminate sentencing structure, requiring him or her to see a parole board, and they're still incarcerated because they've been denied frequently by multiple parole boards. So here's a seven-minute interview, maybe, for somebody who's been incarcerated for 25 years. Is that right? Is that fair? So it's kind of a system that doesn't make any sense. And people just keep scratching their heads, both inside and outside. Is the system broken? Does it make any sense these days?
Beth Schwartz-Appel, a staff writer at the Marshall Project, and Tom Grant is a former New York State Parole Board member from 2004 to 2010. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks
for having us.
Appreciate it.
Great.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. In Arizona, the clemency rate is relatively low as the state's governors are not known for issuing pardons. Former Governor Jan Brewer issued very few. Former Governor Janet Napolitano issued 22 pardons over 6 years. Jane D. Hull issued 7 over more than 5 years, while Fife Symington issued 13 over 6.5 years. Rose Mofford granted 13 over 3 years. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, and joining me now is Phil Latzman. Phil is a new voice you'll be hearing on the show, as well as our news magazines. He joins us from WLRN in Florida. Now, Phil, I know it's only day two for you here, but I understand we've already put you to work.
Yeah, you guys are slave drivers here. In this day and age, though, Mark, we are constantly looking at our computers and our phones, and this got me very interested. Many of us experience extra sensory overload all the time, especially in radio studios like we're in now. Now, this can be especially problematic, though, for epileptics, and they could be in danger of suffering seizures if exposed to too much of this excessive screenery, if you will. Dr. Catherine Noe is a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, and I spoke with her about the impact they can have on all of us, especially those that suffer from epilepsy.
I think the estimate is that in the United States, we all probably spend an average of 7 hours a day looking at television screens, computer screens, our smartphones, and that probably does influence the frequency with which we see seizures manifest. The tendency towards having light or flashing light triggered seizures is probably genetic, so it's always been around. And if you look in studies that have been done, especially in young adults, that tendency may impact as high as 10% of people. Now, only a small percentage of those are ever going to go on to have a seizure, but the concern is that the more time we spend exposed to computer and other screens, and the more that those screens become good at projecting very high-intensity light with a lot of pattern changes, a lot of rapid changes in what you're looking at, that we may start to see more seizures triggered.
One of the things, Dr. Noe, that I've noticed is that you can't avoid these instant pop-up videos. Say, for instance, if you're scrolling through your Facebook feed, videos will automatically start. Your Twitter feeds or whatever social networking you like, these things seem to be unavoidable now. There's no way to stop them or prevent them from popping out at you. Even if you're looking at reading something, all of a sudden something will pop up, a video will pop up. Does that increase the danger, especially for epileptics?
I think it really does. I think, as you pointed out, if somebody knows that they have a sensitivity to flashing light, they can intentionally avoid certain situations. So they could not play a video game that makes them feel bad, or they could not go into a club where they know there might be flashing lights. But when you're turning on your phone with the expectation of, you know, I'm just going to check a news site or I'm just going to check my Twitter account, and all of a sudden a pop-up ad comes on with rapidly flashing light, you really can't prepare or avoid that. And for a small percentage of people, that can be a real problem.
What about non-epileptics? What about everybody, all of us listening, that are exposed to screens every day and everything that we do? As a neurologist, is there an inherent danger in all this? Do we know enough about how it affects the general public that we are in front of these screens being exposed to this media all the time?
I think there is some reason to be concerned. Obviously, we talked about a small group of people where these types of exposures may cause a seizure. There's a broader group of people that the same type of flickering and flashing light sensitivity will induce a migraine or other headache. And then an even larger group where being exposed to those things just makes them feel sick. And sometimes we may lose sight of that when we're in front of those screens all the time. I think it's something that, as a nation, we probably need to pay more attention to.
But you could always listen to your radio and close your eyes, right?
Absolutely.
Dr. Catherine Noe, a neurologist at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix. Dr. Noe, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Coming up, dating is supposed to be fun, right?
It's like an interview, you know? It's like for a job or something. There's only one position open, and that's that one girl.
The state of the date. That's ahead on the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Now on Tuesdays, not just for Thursdays and Fridays anymore. Checking traffic around the valley, US 60 eastbound. There's an accident that has closed the connection ramp to the southbound 101. Elsewhere on the 101 westbound, there's a report of some debris on the roadway at 64th Street. Be aware of that. Valley forecast for the rest of the day, calling for sunny skies with a high of 108. It'll be clear tonight, overnight lows in the mid-80s. Sunny skies for both tomorrow and Thursday, with highs each day right around 107 or 108. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 17%, sunny skies, 106 degrees at KJZZ at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by Stinson Leonard Street. With nearly 500 attorneys providing transactional and litigation legal services from 14 offices across the country, online at stinsonleonard.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Secretary of State John Kerry says the newly reached deal that would curtail Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief is a step in the right direction.
The fact is that the agreement we've reached will bring insight and accountability to Iran's nuclear program, not for a small number of years, but for the lifetime of that program.
Critics of the deal, including members of Congress and some regional allies, say it's a mistake to trust the country to comply with the new terms. The Department of Veterans Affairs says some VA hospitals may close at the end of the month if Congress doesn't provide more funding. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
A surge in demand for veterans' health care and the costly hepatitis C vaccine have left the VA deep in the red this fiscal year. Officials have been asking Congress to let them dip into billions of unspent money from the Veterans Choice Program that was created by Congress last year to let veterans get private health care outside the VA. Without action, the VA may have to shut some hospital operations this August. Critics in Congress say the VA waited months to disclose this budget crisis. They blame the VA's own mismanagement and billion-dollar construction overruns for the shortfall. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The family of the unarmed black man who died after being placed in a chokehold by a New York City police officer says a $5.9 million settlement with the city is not justice. Gwen Carr is the mother of Eric Gardner.
This settlement that we get, people, we're walking up and down the street, they're saying congratulations. Don't congratulate us. This is not a victory. The victory will come when we get justice. Then we want to have a victory party.
Garner had refused to be handcuffed after being stopped on suspicion of selling loose, untaxed cigarettes on Staten Island. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 75 points at 18,053. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. A Maricopa County Superior Court judge dismissed the lawsuit between the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the Board of Education. The judge this morning ruled the court was being asked to decide a political question, not a legal one. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports.
Diane Douglas filed suit against the Board of Education in May, claiming she had the legal authority to hire and fire members. She attempted to fire the executive and deputy director in February, but that decision was overturned by the governor shortly after. The Board of Education argued Douglas was asking the judge to decide the scope of her power, and that isn't the court's jurisdiction. Judge Patricia Starr ruled the statute says the Board of Education sets policy, which the superintendent executes. Douglas has control over the Department of Education, but not over the board. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A judge has signed off on an agreement permanently blocking a 2014 Arizona law that would have made it a crime for former lovers to post nude photos of their former partners online. U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton approved the agreement submitted last week by the American Civil Liberties Union and Attorney General Mark Brnovich. The ACLU argued the law was too broad and could have made criminals out of booksellers, artists, news photographers, and even historians. Bolton had temporarily blocked enforcement of the law last year after the ACLU sued, pending changes made by the legislature. A bill to change the law failed to make it out of both chambers last spring. The legislation sponsor has said he hopes to revive it. State Senator Kelly Ward is challenging U.S. Senator John McCain in next year's Republican primary. Ward's campaign website says she's, quote, running for the U.S. Senate to give you a real choice. The website posting preceded a news conference that Ward scheduled for this afternoon in Lake Havasu City. Ward is a two-term legislator and a physician. McCain announced in April that he'll seek to extend his nearly three-decade career in the Senate by running for a sixth term. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick has announced she'll seek the Democratic nomination for Senate next year. Special forces will be gathering in several southwestern states, including Arizona, for a large-scale training operation. It's been generating some controversy, especially in Texas. Dylan Bedour is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle and has been following this issue. So, Dylan, you've been covering the ramp-up to this Jade Helm operation. What is it, and why is it generating such attention, especially in Texas?
So Jade Helm is an exercise. It's the largest exercise of its kind ever to be conducted, according to the military, although it's unclear what of its kind really means. But it'll bring about 1,200 Special Forces troops, including Navy SEALs and Green Berets, to seven southwestern states starting tomorrow, July 15th. As far as why it's generated such backlash, something about it set off a reaction online. The first thing was a leaked document from the Army detailing the exercise with a map of these seven states, and it labeled Texas as hostile territory. And, of course, this meant simulated hostile territory for the exercise, but people took that and ran with it and developed that into a notion that the federal troops were coming to assert some kind of dominance over Texas and such things.
Has the military made any effort to sort of clarify that, no, we mean this is simulated, we don't actually plan to invade Texas?
Yeah, they've said that just because of the way the military operates, they don't say that much, and they have not said what exactly troops will be doing. But, yes, they have said time and time again they don't plan to invade Texas or disrespect state sovereignty.
For the people who are concerned about this, I mean, do they plan to do anything or go to where the military forces are going to be or anything like that?
Yeah, a small number of people have put together little regiments that they say will do surveillance. We reported the first one on Friday, a Facebook group of several hundred people put together by a man in Arizona, including a Texas branch that planned to camp out with binoculars and watch these drills, although they don't know exactly where they'll be, and report back on them. Subsequently, over the weekend, dozens and dozens of Facebook groups have come up with similar counter Jade Helm agendas, saying that they are going to go and stake out the operations and observe them themselves.
Is the military okay with that?
Military has not made comment on that. I asked for it. They would not address that.
Why are all these troops coming to different states? I mean, obviously there are military bases in those states as well as in other states. Is there a particular reason that they're coming here and that they're sort of leaving where they normally are?
It is exceptional that it's entirely off base, and this is Special Forces, so it's meant to simulate a more mysterious terrain. The Army itself cited that what they called diverse terrain that could replicate areas found overseas. And it's meant to recreate this sort of out-of-home feeling like you were in a hostile territory. And, you know, troops will be drilling then in a place that they really don't know well.
For how long will this operation be going on?
The whole operation runs June 15th to September 15th, although it is unclear for how long troops will be drilling in any one location. That two-month range is all across the seven southwestern states.
Understanding that the military is fairly tight-lipped, as you pointed out, did you get a sense from them that they're concerned about maybe if enough people come to try to stake these things out or see them or maybe even try to interrupt them, that it might kind of defeat the purpose of those all those forces being there?
Well, they haven't said anything like that, but I can say after the Chronicle's first reporting on this back in March, we talked with some law enforcement officials in Texas counties who had been briefed by the Army, and they told us what the Army had told them. And after that news got out, the Army did cancel the drills in those particular counties. And since this whole story has escalated into controversy, they have scaled back the initially planned exercise substantially and rolled back on some plans, for example, that troops would be mingling in with civilian populations trying to remain undercover. They've called that part off.
Dylan Bedour is a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Arizona will play a much more limited role in the exercise. Captain Matthew Murphy of the Arizona National Guard says only about a dozen participants will be in and out of the state from the Special Operations Command of the Army.
Arizona's involvement is extremely limited in terms of just providing some logistical base support for some of the actors in the scenarios. So Arizona, the Arizona National Guard is allowing some of the Jade Helm actors to use a couple of our armories for some couple of overnight stays for what we call R&R or rest and recreation. Yeah, there's going to be just a limited number of Humvees and trucks that are used as part of the exercise that will cross the state lines at various times. So there's no big, caravans of equipment.
Captain Murphy says the military runs operations like this on a smaller scale all throughout the year. He says it's about different agencies being able to cooperate in the event of a national emergency.
We need to know how to work together and to use the kindergarten term, play well together in the sandbox, right? And in order for us to do that, we have to conduct training missions or exercises that allow us to enact simulated real-world scenarios, whether it's an issue of terrain, an issue of demographics, an issue of logistics. We have to carry all these elements that would actually exist in a real-world scenario. They have to be carried out, and in this particular exercise, it's primarily in the Southwest, including Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. So in order for us to have an actual real-world exercise, there are a lot of players involved. So all of the local law enforcement agencies, they're aware, and if they're participating, they have their role. So it's been pre-coordinated and pre-planned, and everybody is definitely working together in an interagency execution to prepare for any potential tragedy or anything that might happen that keeps everybody at the top of their game. The military needs to be at the top of their game. Local law enforcement needs to be at the top of theirs. The National Guard. That's why these exercises go on, and we're doing our part, and we hope that the citizens of Arizona and in the other states allow the exercise to go on unimpaired, so that these individuals can get the training that they need so that they can be ready in the event of an emergency.
Matthew Murphy is a captain in the Arizona National Guard. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. US 60 eastbound. The ramp to the 101 southbound is closed by an accident. 106 degrees at 2:46.
KJZZ is supported by Ironwood Cancer and Research Centers. Support every step of the way, offering individualized treatment plans at their cancer centers in the East Valley, Phoenix, and Scottsdale. More at ironwoodcrc.com.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. An ape is trying to climb on a pole that's 60 feet high. Due to the slippery surface, the ape climbs 3 feet in a minute, only to slip back 2 feet. How much time will it take the ape to reach the top? Hint, the answer is not 60 minutes. When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. For non-physicians, the question, is there a doctor in the house, may not mean much. But for those who'd answer yes, it means they're working to help someone dealing with some kind of medical emergency, often in improvised settings. To get a sense of what that's like, we welcome Dr. Jackie Chadwick, a family physician and vice dean of academic affairs at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix.
I've had that scary voice come over the loudspeaker several times. It's happened to me personally, I would say, maybe 6 to 8 times over my career on an airplane. And I've stopped at accidents on the roadside maybe 3 times in my career. And I've been a physician for over 40 years. So it's not uncommon, but it hasn't happened a whole lot.
What goes into the thought process of should I stop? Can I actually help this person? That sort of thing.
It's not really a difficult decision-making process. If someone needs help and we feel that we're trained to provide that, perhaps better than those who aren't trained, then the automatic response is to do whatever we can do. I have to admit, in the past, there have been a few times when the liability crisis was particularly bad, and there was a lot of discussion about being sued, and it was a real fear that that always was in the back of my mind. But it never caused me not to want to help the individuals. The Good Samaritan law in this state is excellent. In most states, it's very good. So that helped quite a bit to alleviate fears for physicians or, frankly, anybody to provide care.
Is it challenging to kind of know in the back of your mind that you're never really not on call? Like, you could be on vacation, you could be anywhere, and somebody could need help, and you would be the person to help them.
No, it's not a challenge to know that I'm always working, so to speak, because really what I am is a physician. I spend a lot of hours and a lot of years training, and the primary reason for my training was to help people. The common joke for a physician is to be at a cocktail party and have somebody, two or three people, come up and say, "I have this pain here. What is that?" But it happens a lot. Once people know you're a physician, they ask you questions. So part of what we do as a doctor is to educate people and to be able to, number one, listen and show compassion and concern for a person is our primary goal. And if we can give somebody a little bit of relief of their anxiety, then that also helps. I don't ever diagnose. I always tell the person to go see their own physician. So it's really not ever been a problem.
In the instances that you were called on, either stopping on the roadside at the scene of an accident or on an airplane or somewhere else, were there problems that you're familiar with enough that you were really able to help them?
Yes, most of the times I've been called on, especially in an airplane, have been minor enough that I was able to help the person. Probably the worst, the most scariest incident that I had was on a flight between Athens and Alexandria, Egypt, where a person, a young man, actually coded on the plane. He stopped breathing, and I was concerned that he might actually die. That did not fortunately happen. We ended up doing an emergency landing, and the person was, I had to pull the person onto the floor of the airplane and get oxygen onto him. And I actually announced to the rest of the passengers for a particular medicine for asthma that I could give to this person, because that was his problem. It was asthma, and he hadn't taken his medications. So an Australian young woman had some medication, and I was able to get it into him, and he survived.
Do you find that other people are more willing or interested in helping in a situation like that when they know that you are there and you are trained and you are a doctor and you really know what you're doing?
Oh, definitely. I think it mobilizes help with other individuals if somebody takes charge who seems to know a little bit more what to do. If I come upon an accident scene and there's a paramedic there, I don't intervene because they're better prepared than I am to help in that situation. So the best trained person is really the one to take control.
Jackie Chadwick is a family physician and vice dean of academic affairs for the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix. Jackie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jackie referenced knowing when to stop and help and knowing when those already there are better equipped to deal with the situation. So how do those of us with no medical training decide what to do? For those answers, we turn to Steve Newberg, a psychology professor at ASU.
Actually, you have to start a little bit before even the calculation of should I help, should I not help, because it turns out that as we walk through the world, we often miss opportunities that are helping opportunities. We're in a rush. We have our head in our cell phones or the like. Sometimes we see something, but we don't interpret it as actually a situation that requires help. So you see someone who's slumped next to a building. Well, is it someone sleeping off a drunk, or is it someone who's had a heart attack? And so we look for other kind of cues to decide whether this is actually a helping situation or not. Then if you decide it's a helping situation, is it my responsibility to help? That is, should I assume responsibility? Should others assume responsibility? And then once you get past that burden of accepting responsibility, you still have to know what to do. You still have to decide what to do. And we can think about all these kind of circumstances that shift how we move through this sort of series of obstacles, right? So physicians, people who are EMTs, people who are trained, well, they're attuned to circumstances, so they're going to notice.
They'll probably notice the person if they've had a heart attack or if they're just sleeping one off.
That's right. They'll be able to make the right interpretation. Their professional ethics tell them that, in fact, they are responsible, right, for taking care of it, and they have the competence to know what to do. For the rest of us, it's actually a much tougher set of obstacles to surmount.
How much of the calculation is, do I really know what I'm doing, and am I just going to make this person worse off than they are without my intervention?
Yeah, there is a lot of that, and there is a lot that we don't know. And there's also this idea of putting ourselves in personal danger. Yes, this person needs help. Yes, I wish I could do something about it. What kind of risks do I put myself at there? I guess there was a situation last week where someone was getting beaten, I think, on a subway car, and a lot of people watched. Well, the assailant had a knife, and you can imagine what the calculations were of the folks there saying, do I have the skills to disarm someone who's angry and has a weapon? And most of us will probably think that we don't have those skills.
Do you think that people are more likely to help out somebody who is having a medical situation, a heart attack or some other kind of medical situation, as opposed to an episode of violence?
I think that they view themselves as being perhaps a little bit more competent, at least in providing comfort and at least of getting other people involved.
How have these kinds of thought processes evolved over time, especially as states like Arizona have implemented Good Samaritan laws, where if I see somebody on the side of the road and I stop to help and I crack a rib while I'm doing something, they can't then sue me because I was trying to help them? How has that sort of changed the thought process?
I mean, I think that's important. You know, again, we think about the noticing, the interpreting as a problem, assuming responsibility, and then knowing what to do. Well, if we don't know what to do, we worry that maybe we're going to make something worse than not. What the Good Samaritan law essentially says, you're better off trying, right? Better to try something than to not try at all. And it gives us license to do that. So I think it's important for that last stage. I don't think it does much, though, to get us past those earlier stages.
Is there a factor of guilt here that we walk past something and we think to ourselves, I really don't want to get involved with this for any number of reasons, but I mean, I got to be a better person than that.
I think that does happen sometimes, and I think people feel guilty afterwards for walking past things or driving past accidents on highways and the like. People think about ideas of guilt and shame as being these horrible emotions, but they exist for a reason. They exist to help us be our better selves, our better community selves, to better assume our responsibilities that we have towards one another in this sort of agreement we have that we call society.
So if you don't get involved the first time and you feel bad about it, maybe the next time you're more likely to get involved.
As a way of, in fact, preemptively managing the emotions that you don't want to experience.
Steve Newberg is a psychology professor at ASU. Steve, thank you.
Thank you. Happy to help.
Nothing says romance quite like a bunch of people in a room arguing. The show's Annika Klein reports on a traveling debate forum coming to Phoenix that poses the question, why is everyone here single?
Picture this. 200 men and women sit on opposite sides of a theater. Every one of them is single and ready to mingle, but sometimes reaching across the aisle to make that happen is not so easy.
You think you're open, but you're not open. You got the phone in the hand, you got the friends protecting you.
Look, everybody, we're all human beings, right? And at the end of the day, you either connect with people or you don't. If you're shut off with the iPhone or whatever, then that's your choice.
It's called the Great Love Debate, and it travels from city to city. And tomorrow, it hits Phoenix. Brian Howie started the debates to get local singles involved in the discussion.
My job is to raise questions, and the audiences sort of provide a lot of the answers.
After 83 shows, Howie has noticed some regional differences in audiences around the country. For example, audiences in the South are generally younger than those in other areas. And on the coasts, he says, people tend to be more headstrong in their opinions. But for many across the country, this isn't their first dating rodeo.
So a lot of them are single again, or single longer, or they're encountering a different landscape in 2015 than they might have encountered in 1995. 20 years ago, if you wanted to say hi to somebody, you had to say hi to them. Real life.
But real life is not always so easy.
It's like an interview, you know? It's like for a job or something. There's only one position open, and that's that one girl. And so, you know, you put it in perspective, that's how it's like.
Lucas Pagelstump is sitting on the patio of a Scottsdale bar. He's here for a singles event, in real life no less. He hopes that meeting with a group will make it a little easier to mingle.
Going by yourself to a club or a bar or something like that, it causes tension.
Howie's advice? Don't overthink things.
You know, your only goal on a first date really should be a second date. That's it.
But how do you get to the second date? Well, that's debatable. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
The Great Love Debate will be at Phoenix Theater tomorrow at 7:30.
Be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock for KJZZ's Here and Now. Steve Goldstein with all the latest news from around the state. And then on Thursday, we're right back here with the show at 2 o'clock. Among the stories we'll have for you, why a researcher decided to map high school graduation rates for every district across the country and what it says about districts here in the Phoenix area and around Arizona. That story and much more on the show on Thursday at 2, then the show again on Friday at 2 o'clock. The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. All Things Considered is next on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo, where personalized conversations can help you reach your financial goals. Because an open dialogue can open doors, Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.